Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the award-winning Follow Your Dream podcast with listeners worldwide in 200 countries on every continent. I am Robert Miller, your host. I am so pleased that this is the second 60s Jamboree that I'm bringing you, featuring five superstars from that fabulous era. I'm going to introduce them in alphabetical order. And when I do, please say hi. First up, Jeremy Clyde of the iconic duo, Chad and Jeremy. Their hits include A Summer Song and Yesterday's Gone.
Hi, guys. Great to be here.
All right. Next up, Richie Furay, an original member of Buffalo Springfield, Poco, and the Souther Hillman Furay Band. And his hits include Kind Woman and Picking Up the Pieces.
Hey there, Robert. How are you? And everybody else out there. Good to see you.
Fantastic. Next up, Tommy James of Tommy James and the Shondells fame. Their string of hits included Hanky Panky, Crimson and Clover, and I Think We're Alone Now.
Hi, how's everybody doing?
All right. Next one, Gary Puckett of Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, with hits that included Woman, Woman, and Young Girl. And I promised I would say this. This weekend, Gary and the Union Gap will be headlining at the 60s Rock and Roll Revival show at the New Jersey State Theater, together with Gary Lewis, the Grassroots, and the Brooklyn Bridge. How about that?
It'll be fun.
All right. And last but certainly not least, we've got Noel Paul Stuckey, who is Paul of Peter, Paul, and Mary, the extraordinary trio that also had a string of hits, including Puff the Magic Dragon and Leaving on a Jet Plane. Say hi, Noel.
Hey, it's great to see you guys.
All right. When you guys were in your prime, way back when, did you ever think you'd be doing a show like this 60 years later?
You mean a mutual television show? Sure, this is just another television show, Robert. I was asking Jeremy if we'd ever been on one of those England band programs.
I believe I met you, but I remember it was in a club called the Pickwick, which you came down to, which was a sort of hangout for all of us. I don't think you're one of those sort of Thank You Lucky Stars or a 6-5 special, all those sort of things.
That's right.
I don't think we ever crossed us at the same time, I'm afraid. I don't remember that we did. But hello, anyway.
I was wondering if Richie did TV in England. Did you do TV in England?
We did do, the old whistle stop? Was that a...
Yeah, the old grey whistle test. That's it.
This is BBC Two. Now Bob Harris introduces this week's edition of the old grey whistle test.
Yeah, we did that one a long time ago.
Yeah.
How do I even remember that now?
And I never knew what that meant. It apparently was a phrase to do with if somebody is old and grey and can be heard whistling your tune in the street, you've got a hit.
I thought it was just an excuse for drinking.
That too?
You know, wet your whistle, as it is.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, anyway, I was told that. I never knew what it meant for ages. But it's to do with, you know, if you've got some old guy in the street, some milkman. People don't have milkmen anymore. And people don't whistle anymore, by the way.
That's right.
Whistling is gone. I'm a terrible whistler. Any of you guys whistle?
Oh, yeah. I love to whistle. Drive my wife crazy.
Yeah.
All right. Listen, a little quiz. What song by the Lovin' Spoonful featured a whistle?
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I can hear the song, just can't think of the tune.
What a Day for a Daydream.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Perfecto.
Day for a Daydream.
There you go. All right, listen, I want to find out. We've got five wonderful artists. How many times did each of you appear on the Ed Sullivan Show? Start with you, Tommy. How many times?
Well, we appeared four times and then they reran, two times and they reran it another two times. So I guess we were on four times.
We'll count that as four. Okay. Gary, I think I know the answer from you, but why don't you tell everybody?
Actually, I was on three times and they've been playing those things over and over and over again for years. So I'm fortunate there.
All right. Richie, what about you?
Zip.
Really?
Not one time.
Buffalo Springfield was never on the Ed Sullivan Show?
We never stayed together long enough.
All right. Jeremy, what about you?
No, we didn't. And the reason we didn't was because we were brought over to America by the opposition, which was called the Hollywood Palace Show, which was the West Coast answer competition. So we weren't allowed anywhere near because we were with the other guys.
But if I remember correctly, you did Batman and the Dick Van Dyke Show.
We did two episodes of Batman. Chad and Jeremy played Gotham City, and the Catwoman in the middle of one of our songs, which was a hit at the time, came on with a zapper sort of ray gun thing. And then she took our voices and she's going to put them in a box and hold the British government to ransom. And the British government, by the way, refused to pay up. Huh. But I can say this with truth. I am here today with my voice restored to me solely because of the good work of Batman and Robin, and there's not a lot of people can say that.
No, that's impressive.
That's a great story.
Noel, what about you? Did you guys appear on Ed Sullivan?
No, we never did. We did quite a few late night shows, you know, with Steve Allen, Saturday Night Live type things. One with our breakout was with Jerry Lewis, who was filling in for the host. And that's where Peter, Paul, and Mary first had their television exposure.
All right. What about all those other great shows? You had Hullabaloo. And where the action is.
Oh, baby, come on. Let me take you where the action is. Oh, baby, come on. Let me take you where the action is. Oh, baby, come on. Let me take you where the action is. It's so neat to meet your baby where the action is.
Were you guys on those shows as well?
We hosted a Hullabaloo.
Wow.
And we did the shows as well, but we actually hosted one. You know.
My first network show is Where the Action Is. And my manager today, Carol Ross, was one of the dancers on the show. She was an action dancer.
Wow.
Hullabaloo, I seem to remember there were a lot of, they tend to put the dancers in cages.
Those were the days.
Well, quite.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I don't think you can do that anymore. That's for sure.
Either literally or figuratively.
That's exactly right. Hi, everybody. This is Robert Miller, your host. As a musician and composer, I've crossed multiple genres. My early work includes jazz rock instrumentals like Spring Dance. And ballads like Ma Petite Fleur. Later on, I segued into vocal songs like Redemption Road.
But I'll come back.
And along the way, I added collaborations with world-class musicians like Jim Peterik, Elliot Randall, and Tony Carey on The Fall of Winter.
He said, stand up to yourself, be true. Don't let the fall of winter get the best of you. Had a voice like a boat from the blue.
I also pride myself on the reimagined covers I've done, including The In Crowd.
I'm in with the in crowd. I go where the in crowd goes. I'm in with the in crowd. And I know what the in crowd knows. Yeah, yeah.
And then recently, I've come full circle with The Rich Ones, a jazz instrumental with guest artist Randy Brecker. For me, crossing genres helps keep the music fresh. Once again, I want to thank you all for listening to this podcast, and keep on rocking. You know what? We got some great songs to play here, and I want to get to that second portion of this. And I want to start out in no particular order with Tommy's first song, okay? And we're playing Hanky Panky right now.
My baby does the hanky panky. Yeah, my baby does the hanky panky. Hey, my baby does the hanky panky. My baby does the hanky panky. Hey, my baby does the hanky panky.
Tommy, first of all, tell us a little bit about Hanky Panky and how that all came about.
Well, first of all, I recorded it in 1964, early 64. I was a junior in high school, and we recorded it in the WNIL. That's in my little hometown of Niles, Michigan. And we recorded it in the radio studio. The producer was the day DJ on WNIL. Jack Douglas was his name, not the famous one. And it was released locally and sold about four records. And, basically we had no distribution, so it did nothing. In 65, I graduated from high school and took my band on the road. And I'm playing a dumb little bar in Janesville, Wisconsin. And all of a sudden, the IRS shut the guy down in the middle of my 2 weeks for not paying his taxes. And we got sent home. Back to Niles, Michigan. But that's how the good Lord works, because as soon as I got home, I got a call that my life. Seems that a disc jockey in Pittsburgh had played Hanky Panky. They bootlegged it, and it jumped on the charts at number one. And they tracked me down because it was written on the little record label, Niles, Michigan. And if I hadn't been home at that moment, if that guy hadn't gone belly up, we wouldn't be talking here today, because I would have never known about Hanky Panky. It was number one in Pittsburgh, and then we went to New York and sold it to Roulette and blah, 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 went on and on. But that was literally the beginning of my career.
All right, listen, you have a great story. I think it's about Crimson and Clover, where you gave a demo to the radio station. Tell that story.
Well, this is early 1960, and we did the whole record in like 5 hours, Crimson and Clover, and I made a rough mix, 7.5 rough mix, mixed it basically with my elbows, and I just threw up the faders. It was a work tape. And so I took it home to listen to it, and the next day we were in Chicago. And doing a concert. And I happened to take the tape with me, and we went up to WLS, which at that time was the biggest station in the country. And went up and I played it for the program director, John Rook. And he loved it. He flipped out and he brings somebody else in into the radio studio to listen. He said, play that again. And we played Crimson and Clover, this rough mix, and he taped my tape. And I got back into the car. I said my goodbyes and I had no idea he taped it. And I went down into the car and the radio was on and I hear, world exclusive on WLS, Tommy Dane and Crimson, and they played this rough mix and I'm dying. And I went back to Roulette and they said, what the hell did you do? And so they had, you know, it was this whole, I ended up having to release the rough mix as the single. And the single of Crimson and Clover is the rough mix that I did that night with my elbows.
Wow.
I'm not kidding. It was the biggest record we ever had. So
that's a great story. All right, Richie, on that first Buffalo Springfield album, if I remember correctly, you sang two songs that Neil Young wrote that he didn't want to sing, or he just thought you could sing better. One of them, if I remember, was Sit Down, I Think I Love You. Am I correct?
Yes. Actually, that's a Stephen Stills song.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm playing that one underneath you now. Tell me something about that song, and then tell me about the Neil Young songs that I just mentioned.
Well, Sit Down, I Think I Love You was a great song. Obviously, it was covered by the Mojo Men, and they had a big hit of it. The most special thing about it was that there was these two girls that came, and they stood right in front of us at the Whiskey-A-Go-Go, and I pinned out one of them, and I would just sing that song to that girl. And she's my bride of 57 years today. But I'd say, Sit Down, I Think I Love You. And here we are today.
Fantastic.
And the Neil Young songs that I sang were Nowadays Clancy Can't Even Sing. Neil taught me that song in New York when he came down to peddle some songs in New York. And we were in a band. Oh, boy. The Agogo Singers. I'm sorry. I had to say that, but that's who we were. We were the house band at the Cafe Agogo there in New York. But anyway, Neil came down to peddle some songs, and I wish I had the tape recording of it today, because he taught me Nowadays Clancy Can't Even Sing, that I put on an old Revere tape recorder that I had lugged to New York, you know, to be a famous folk singer like this other guy named Stookie over there. But but anyway, I don't know what it was with Neil. I don't think that it wasn't that he didn't want to sing his songs. I think that the record company wanted to find something for me to do. And so I ended up singing three of his songs on the first album. Do I Have to Come Right Out and Say It?
Do I have to come right out and say it? Tell you that you look so fine. Do I have to come right out and ask you to be mine? If it was a game I could play.
Nowadays, Clancy Can't Even Sing.
Joining and listening and talking in rhymes. Stopping the feeling to wait for the time. Who's saying, baby, that don't mean a thing? Cause nowadays, Clancy can't even sing.
And flying on the ground is wrong.
But if crying and holding on and flying on the ground is wrong, then I'm sorry to let you down. But you're from my side of town and I'll miss you.
I actually did them in a medley a long time ago in my little solo band. And then when Buffalo Springfield got together, golly, I guess this is about 10 years ago, we did a reunion, and Neil and I got together first off, and we were putting, you know, kind of putting the set list together. And I said, hey, Neil, you know, I've been doing a medley of some of your songs in my set. And why don't we just start there? And he said, no, every song has to stand on its own. No medley. So we ended up doing two of the songs during. The only one we did nowadays, Clancy Can't Even Sing and Do I Have to Come Right Out and Say It in that reunion. But yeah, Neil was very adamant about that. And I love the songs. I mean, some of them I can't even tell. I don't have a clue what Clancy is about. I mean, but it was so unique, you know, with the 3-4, 4-4 back and forth. And Neil was quite a, you know, unique writer. I think his early songs, you know, really, they really impressed me a lot. So I did sing quite a few of his songs on that first album, and there you have it.
All right. We just learned that he's an anti-medley guy.
He is definitely an anti-medley guy. I mean, it was one word, no.
All right. Hey, Noel, we're playing now I Dig Rock and Roll Music, which was kind of a different song for you guys.
I dig rock and roll music and love to get the chance to play
and sing it.
I figure it's about the happiest sound going down today. The message may not move me or mean a great deal to me, but hey, it feels so groovy to say.
You came out of a whole folk background. And now you're rocking. Tell us about that.
I think, you know, a lot of people misinterpreted our intentions. We knew these folks. I mean, it was a brief meeting with the Beatles on the set for Hard Day's Night. But Donovan and I kept running into each other on Broadway, going back and forth between studios. And Mama Cass and Mary were real tight. So, you know, when I sat down with Jim Mason, who Richie Furey knows.
Yeah.
Because I think he was producer of a couple of your albums, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anyway, Jim Mason and I and Dave Dixon, a DJ from Detroit, sit down in a New York apartment, and Jim's got this bop bow bidden do da do bop bop do do bop do right, and he's got some really awkward melody like I love you very, very much, and I'd love to look into your eyes. You know, I go, Jim, that is a terrible lyric for such a bouncy tune. So we had a gas putting it together, and in the studio, that's where we really had fun. We borrowed Skip Prokop from Lighthouse. You remember that group? A Canadian group. That's why at the tag end, when we're doing our ba 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 ba, as I say, go tell him, Skip, and he plays like a little riff. But Peter did a backwards acoustic guitar that sort of echoes wah, 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 from the Beatles. The only thing I regret about the tune, because I loved all, I thought the lyrics were really clever that we co-wrote, it was the intimation that the Beatles were selling love. But it was the only rhyme scheme. It was the only rhyme I could come up with. Because, frankly, if you look at their catalog and the continuing catalog of McCartney, they really have professed a larger love than I think most people realized at the time. And that is, to me, the ultimate political statement. You know, the bringing together of all of us under this umbrella called love. So I only, you know, the inference that it was monetarily driven, I regret to this point. But they used to call us Pizza Poo and Magpie. So maybe it's a just reward.
Pizza Poo and Magpie. That's cool. All right, Jeremy.
Yeah.
I mentioned Jukebox Jerry, your big hit, which was a summer song.
They say that all good things must end.
Tell us about your experience with Jukebox Jerry.
Well, yeah, we had had a hit with a song that Chad wrote called Yesterday's Gone.
I loved you all the summer through.
found my dream in you. For me, you were the one. But that was yesterday, and yesterday's gone.
Which later broke into America via, interestingly and surprisingly, the country charts. And then they discovered we were English and had we were out of there rather quickly and crossed over. Anyway, this show, Jukebox Jury, four celebrities, and they play 30 seconds of the new release, and you'd be asked to raise a thing saying hit or miss. And to spice this up a bit, because it's not the hottest TV format, let's face it, four people just sitting, you'd sometimes have the act backstage waiting to find out whether they were going to be humiliated or celebrated, right? And in this case, they got Chad, who I don't know how I got out of it, but Chad's sitting there waiting to find out whether the axe is going to fall or whatever. Then they get to the moment, they play first 30 seconds, and now come on, that was Chad and Jeremy. It's a summer song. Do you think it's going to be a hit or a miss? And Ringo's on the panel, right? And they all go, miss. And Chad is downcast, miserable. And then Ringo says, you know something? They're nice lads. It's too soft for England. But I think it could be a very big hit in America. So there you are, Ringo the Prophet. Who knew? He called it. And we never were able to follow up our first hit, Yesterday's Gone, in England. And that's how we ended up in America. And, you know, the rest is...
rest is history. All right, Gary, let's go to you now. You had that monster hit with Woman, Woman. And you had that other monster hit, Young Girl.
You led me to believe you're old enough to give me love. And now it hurts to know the truth. Oh, young girl, get out of my mind. My love for you is way out of line. Better run, girl.
I said to myself as I was preparing this, could you ever write and put out Young Girl at this time in the world? I mean, it's kind of a risque song when you think about it, but it was a gigantic hit for you. Tell us about that one.
Well, could it happen now? I don't know. 50 years later, it's hard to say, you know, what could happen in the world in the way it is. I mean, I've seen a number of people online put that song down. I've seen them misunderstand the lyric. I've seen others say, hey, here's a guy who is upstanding and he fell in love with a girl that lied to him and said she was old enough. And then he finds out she's not. So he says, listen, I love you too much to let you do this. And you have to get out of here. You have to go. And I've seen many online say, okay, yes, we see what's happening today. I don't know. Would it work? I think so. I think it's a great song. I think it's a very forward song, and it's an innocent song in its way, you know. So that's my opinion of it. I'll just leave it at that.
You know, I have a lot of different musicians on the show, and I had one guy recently who produced a whole bunch of rap music. And if I tell you, he played three songs on the show, they were the filthiest lyrics that you could possibly imagine. Okay. It was F this and F that. And I kept saying to myself, this stuff could never have gotten on the air back in the day.
Oh, no.
Somehow it works today. Mm. What can I say?
We had censorship back then. You remember censorship. The Stones were supposed to say, let's spend some time together. Jagger didn't do that. He said, let's spend the night together. They made me say in the line, I'm afraid we'll go too far. They made me say, how can this love of ours go on? Which fit the song, which was okay. And I'm okay with that. But we had censorship in those days, and we don't have that anymore.
Did any others of you have that same situation?
No, not that situation, but there was a lot of dumbing down. I mean, we were constantly being told, no, no, you've got to make it, frankly, stupider, because the kids, you know, get down with the kids. It was then Dylan arrives and everyone goes, oh, right, hang on, that was wrong then. You know what I mean? But when sort of in the pop market, the pressure was to be very sort of, you know, one syllable.
All right.
I didn't have a lyric problem, but I had to change an album cover one time because of I Think We're Alone Now, the album, because we had two sets of footprints going up and then facing each other. And apparently they overlapped a little too much. And radio wasn't going to play the records because they thought it was a dirty record with the crickets in the background. And we had a hell of a time with there was a radio station in Detroit, Keener Radio in Detroit, who refused to play the record because of the album cover. So I literally had to change the album cover. And of course, meanwhile, their number one record was Let's Spend the Night Together by the Rolling Stones. So so much for hypocrisy.
I'm just wondering, you know, Tommy, your background, everybody knows you had such a rough time with Roulette Records. And why don't you just briefly describe what happened there? And I'm wondering if anybody else had a similar kind of situation where you didn't get paid your royalties and they took advantage of you. Tommy, just give a little brief introduction about Roulette.
Sure. We wrote a book about it called Me, the Mob, and the Music. And the bottom line is that unbeknownst to us, when we signed with Roulette back in 1906, that's because I'm old. Do the math. Anyway, unbeknownst to us, when we signed with Roulette, in addition to being a functioning, pretty decent record company, indie label, was also a front for the Genovese crime family in New York. And of course, that created all kinds of problems for us, none the least of which was getting mechanical royalties was just not going to happen. You know, crime doesn't pay, you know. So the bottom line was that we didn't get paid. We were behind between 30 and 40 mil before we left the label. But by the same token, if we had gone with one of the big corporate labels that we could have gone with, because Hanky Panky broke out of a major market in Pittsburgh, we would have never had the success we had at Roulette, because we would have been turned over to an in-house A&R man, a producer. And the competition, if we'd have gone with CBS, Columbia, we would have, the competition would have been so brutal that's probably the last time anybody would have ever heard from us. At Roulette, they actually needed us. So, you know, it was a constant weighing whether to try to leave or whether to stay. And as I said, we would have never had the kind of success that we had with Roulette anywhere else, I'm sure of it.
Peter, Paul, and Mary had a similar grassroots record deal with Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers was working out of Quonset huts in Burbank. And we were one of the first three acts that they signed. I think Bill Cosby was one, and I can't remember who the other. Oh, no. No, there was a short, fat, tubby comic. I can't remember his name.
Oh, that guy, yeah.
That guy, I'm sure he's watching us today. But anyway, we always had, I mean, Warner Brothers was family, and we were family for them. Mike Maitland was the president.
Yeah.
And that record division just took off out of the film corporation, and now they're a monster. I mean, Warner's is very good. They've always been very good for us. But what is it about audits? You know, 3 years later, you can audit the company, and we're continually finding what mistakes can they possibly make after 3 years? Haven't they figured it out by then?
Well, they got to figure out how to steal your money first, you know.
Well, and then we have to figure out who to hire to get them to find out who they
Gary and Richie, did you have similar problems with the record labels or not?
Well, Like Tommy, my first record was on Roulette with the Agogo Singers. Fortunately, again, we didn't stay around long enough to really get into some of the stuff that he did. And golly, man, I'm just really proud of you that you're still here today, Tommy. Because I love you, man. But yeah, you know, I feel like Poco was actually a swap. You know, I was on Atlantic and Graham Nash was on Epic and we became a baseball trade. And I don't think when we ended up, when Poco ended up on Epic, that really the company knew what to do with us. We were pioneering a quote unquote new sound. It wasn't new. It was something that Carl Perkins and Gene Vincent and the guys were rockabillying back, you know, in the 50s or whatever. But we were given, you know, the title of starting a California country rock thing. And I don't think Epic really understood what we were doing or why we, you know, what it was all about at the time. And so they kind of like let us go for a long time, you know. I mean, Poco finally had a hit after I left the band a long time ago with Crazy Love. And but it was kind of frustrating, you know. We were drawing great audiences, particularly in every SUNY back in New York. We played every gymnasium you can imagine back there and great audiences, but we just couldn't crack the AM market. We just didn't get any success from them.
Hmm. Interesting. Gary, what about you?
No, it was all pretty straightforward for us. CBS Columbia was, you know, they were well established as CBS and Columbia Records. And, you know, when I met Jerry Fuller, he had a plan, and fortunately that plan was to sit on the other side of the glass to find somebody that he could record. He wanted to be a writer, producer, etc., and I wanted to be an artist, a singer, a guitar player, whatever, and I walked into his office at the right time. He had written a song by that Ricky Nelson had recorded, and it sold 4 million copies. A song which Jerry had actually written for Sam Cooke, who did not want the song, but Ricky did, and it was a big success for him. So he moved, I think, from Texas somewhere and came into Los Angeles and was looking for his fame and fortune as a writer, producer. And I walked into his office at the right time, and the whole situation was just really tailor-made for Jerry, for me. He was able to call together all the right elements, you know, to make hit records and so forth. And he did a good job by Gary Puckett and the Union Gap.
Excellent. Jeremy, you got any stories here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, we never got paid. Oh, my God. We were leased to a little company called World Artist Records, run out of a bathroom in Pittsburgh. And they didn't like paying for anything much, I mean. And eventually we got Alan Klein of Beatles fame to get us out of that contract and on to Columbia. But, you know, the big hits were World Artists. And later we tried to get some settlement, and I called a music business lawyer and said, okay, here's the thing, chart placings, years, blah, blah, blah. And he, after a bit, he called back and he said, okay, you called me for advice, is that right? Yes, I said, yeah. He said, okay, let me put it to you this way. The guys you were with are, how can I put this, connected. And my advice to you is you can go after them and it could get very messy, or you can just walk away and have a very nice life. And that's my advice to you. Later, we managed to get out of the English side of the record company. There was a lawsuit. And they got a bit clever, and we got in there and got some money, and now we get slightly paid for the very few plays that we get of our records. But yeah, it all sort of, that's high. But no, we were ripped off. Now, I remember, Tommy, this is a book called Hitman, if I remember. Anyone know this book?
Yes.
I remember it, which is a fantastic book. And it's all the villains and Roulette figures, as I remember, in the book. If you haven't ever read it, boy, it's tremendous. Mark you, what they did to the Black Act was even worse, but there you are.
All right. I got one more question for you guys. And that is, I've heard so many stories with all my guests about how a record got picked up at random by a disc jockey somewhere in America. And he just got behind it and started playing it. And that was how the ball got started and got rolling. Sometimes they even turned it over where they took the B side and decided that that should be the A side. Who's had that experience?
Peter, Paul, and Mary, San Francisco. We're working the Hungry Eye, and some disc jockey by the name of Buck Herring starts playing Lemon Tree.
Lemon tree, very pretty, and the lemon flower is sweet, but the fruit of the poor lemon is impossible to eat. Lemon tree, very pretty, and the lemon flower is sweet, but the fruit of the poor lemon is impossible to eat.
And playing it, and playing it, and playing it, and reporting it. And finally, those were the days when DJs looked at the Billboard and said, what is this? What? So many plays, what? And that was our first, that was the song that I'm sure all you guys have experienced, where we pulled over to the side of the road as it came on the radio and giggled because we had never heard ourselves on the radio before. That was beautiful. That was very early 60s, like 62 maybe. And then from there on, it was once you've crossed the threshold, then at least you demand a hearing sort of from the radio world. And they'll at least play what you've submitted. So from Lemon Tree, it went to Hammer.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning. I'd a hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd a hammer out of danger. I'd a hammer out of warning. I'd a hammer out of love between my brothers and my sisters.
From Hammer to Blowing in the Wind.
How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
The March on Washington, the fact that the group aligned itself so many times with the concerns of the country and the world and people, that a lot of the material then became reflective of the times in which we lived rather than, you know, a love song or something. But then that all turned around with John Denver's Leaving on a Jet Plane, when Mary did such a beautiful delivery job, and it became our first and only number one single.
So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again.
All right, Tommy, I think you were saying you had the same experience with a DJ.
Well, I told you that in Pittsburgh, the Hanky Panky just got pulled out of an old record cemetery, a has-been, I don't know, and played on the radio. And, you know, it was the old story, the switchboard lights up, and they ended up bootlegging 80,000 copies, and they sold them in Pittsburgh. And that's how my career got started. It was a major market, which was unusual. Usually that sort of thing happens in a little, you know, Sandusky somewhere. But this was a major market. And we immediately then were able to take the record to New York and sell the master to a major label. Only in America. And I don't know that that can happen anymore, because the record business, what's left of it, is just not made for that anymore. Nobody can be that independent.
That's true. All right, who else? Anybody else got a story like that?
Well, not a story like that, but just to say that in having failed to get a summer song off the ground at all in America, in England, when we went to America, the disc jockeys pulled it in the summer of 64, right after Yesterday Is Gone, and almost back to back. They went to the album, went into it, and said, oh, this, we think this is, and it became the song of the summer, that summer, and then many summers after it, you know. So, yeah.
So my story is just a little bit different in this regard. Woman was our first release, and it was getting some airplay. The flip side, Don't Make Promises You Can't Keep, written by Tim Hardin, was getting some airplay. And Jerry Fuller, our producer, said to me, well, you know, it's A side, B side, one's working against the other, so we may have to go in and record again and try once again with another release. So it turns out that going back a ways, I had decided that we should dress ourselves in some fashion that it would stop people in their tracks. Not quite, maybe, but I thought, you know, if we look a little different than everybody else, and you remember what we were wearing back then, you know, fringes and paisleys and tie-dyes and all the stuff that we were wearing, plus holy jeans were coming in, and we were all dressing the, what is it I want to say? You know, we were the anti-American kind of anti-social, you know, whatever. And I said, no, we gotta do something that's a little different. So I had decided on these Union Soldier outfits, which the band thought was really stupid. But I took them to a place in Los Angeles, rented one, went to Tijuana, Mexico, had them made. Well, at any rate, fast forward now, the record is out. I had negotiated with the record company, if you could call it negotiation, because record companies really, you can't negotiate with them. I said, put a picture of us on the record. They said, no, we're not going to do that. We don't do that. They finally relented after much discussion, put a picture of us that had been taken in a school on the stage in the auditorium that had been destroyed by the wrecking ball. And it really looked authentic because it was done in sepia tone, and a couple of inside jokes were in the picture, but nobody saw them. And there was a disc jockey in Columbus, Ohio, when he saw the picture. He said, this is a fantastic picture. Well, guess what? He was a Civil War historian, and he loved the picture. He said, what does this record sound like? There's some thought here, you know? So he played it, loved it, put it on the station, WCOL. I think his name was Bob Harrington, and it went to number one in Columbus. And that's when the Cleveland office of Columbia Records called me and said, did you know that you have a hit record in Columbus, Ohio? I said, how could I know that? But that's kind of the story that I'm trying to tell here. Led to our success is all I'm trying to say.
All right, Richie, anything on your end there?
Well, the only hit record that I've actually been a part of, and it only went to number 7 in the country, was a song that went right over my head. The first Buffalo Springfield album really didn't have the success that Ahmet Erdogan thought it was going to have, and he came out to hear some new songs, and we were sitting at Stephen's house, and Neil played some songs, and Stephen played some songs, and I played some songs, and as we were closing up and getting ready to go, Stephen said, oh, I have one more for What It's Worth, and bingo. Ahmet said, that's a hit, man, we got to record that song, and it's become the national anthem of protest songs, I think, or close to it, with Stop, Hey, What's That Sound, Everybody Look What's Going Down.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
You know, and there's a funny story that you've told about that, because everybody thinks it was like an anti-war protest song. Tell us what the real answer was.
Well, there was an issue going on at the corner of Crescent Heights, Sunset Boulevard, and Laurel Canyon called Pandora's Box, where a lot of kids got together to kind of party and have a good time during that time. And Stephen ran across, I mean, he was on the street there I don't know what he was doing, but he saw some kind of chaos going on. And that's when he wrote the song about this. The police were shutting down that particular club called Pandora's Box. And there was a big protest that was going on right there at that intersection in L.A.
Social insight.
Well, as you say, it's taken on a life of its own. All right. Listen, this has been a wonderful, wonderful thing to do with you guys. What's going on in the future for you guys? Why don't you go right down the line? Tell us who's doing what, where. Tommy, you want to start it off?
Well, we're touring all over the country this year. I have my radio show on Sirius XM every Sunday called Getting Together with Tommy James. Me, the Mob, and the Music, the book, is going to become a movie. And we're very excited about that. I'm just as busy as I've ever been. And so I'm just thankful to the fans and the good Lord for the kind of longevity we've had and being able to still do this after all these years.
Who's going to play you in the movie, Tommy?
Walter Brennan. No, I'm not sure. They're actually in the casting phase right now. Barbara DeFina is producing, who produced Goodfellas and Casino and Hugo a few years ago with Martin Scorsese. And she's just a brilliant producer. And they're in the casting phase right now. I'm the worst one to ask, because what's amazing to me is that all of the really good young male actors came from rock bands. So many of them started out as singing guitar players. I can't believe it. So, but the challenge is to find somebody who plays guitar as badly as I do. That's so anyway. So at any rate, it's going to be fun watching it all come together.
Jeremy, what's happening with you?
Well, ever since Chad left us, I don't know, what is that, 3-4 years ago now, and Gordon Waller, many years ago now, Peter Asher and I had been looking at each other and going, well, obviously, you know, and so we've been doing the Peter and Jeremy show, which has been very well received and selling out, you know, lots of stories and clips of, you know, Dick Van Dyke show and Batman, all kinds of fun things like that. But I'm slightly waiting for Peter to come back and stop being so busy and get back to the important business of doing our show. I just, one thing about that was that Mrs. Peter's joke in very, very bad taste. So I'm not responsible for this. But as he says, the right guys died. Because I sing the low parts, right? And Peter was singing the high parts. So anyway, there you are. It's a sick joke.
I saw Peter and Jeremy last summer, and they are fantastic, I have to say. All right, Richie, what's happening with you?
Well, like Tommy, I'm busier than all get out. I'm trying to retire, but getting ready to head off to California next week. Just came back from Missouri, then I go back to the East Coast doing some concerts. And I do have a documentary that the people that are managing me at this time, late time in my career, David Stone and Denny Klein have put together a documentary. Cameron Crowe is involved in it, which is really important for us.
Yeah.
And it'll be coming out next year. We started it before COVID, and COVID shut everything down. So it's been like dragging its feet. But a little storytelling on my life, which is kind of interesting. You know, I dropped out of the music business for 35 years to pastor a church, and then finally retired from the pulpit ministry and got to playing music again. So just on the road traveling and trying to, you know, keep my head above water here. We're having a great time. And like Tommy too, I'm just thanking the good Lord for keeping me here, and good to see all of you guys. That's all I can say, man. It's just really special to see your faces and to know that we're all still out there just plugging away, doing whatever we do.
There you go. Gary, you're up next. What's happening with you?
Well, I'm still out there. I've got a great band, and I feel really blessed, you know, just like the other guys here. I just feel blessed to be able to go out there. The fans still seem to love me. They still want to hear me sing. So we're getting out there a lot and working on different things with the, oftentimes they call them the revivals and all that sort of stuff. Here we are 50 plus years later, and those songs are being played on Sirius XM, and I've done a few DJ spots For Sirius, and I'm going to put together another one here because I have many fans out there. In fact, I just called Flash Phelps this morning to wish him happy birthday. So the rest of you ought to follow suit on that one because he loves that. So anyway, I've got a film, a song coming out that my brother and I wrote for a film that I believe is going to be called The Test. Kind of a nice deal. And I'm just going to continue working and having a good time and spending time with my grandkids.
That's good. All right, Noel, you're up.
Well, let's see. In a week's time, I'm going to fly from the West Coast where I currently am. Would love to see you, Richie, by the way, to Boston, to the Folk Americana Roots Hall of Fame, the Pfarrhof, who are inducting 28 of us into the museum. That'll be Joni and, quite a few folkies. And then honoring some people from the past, Seeger and the Weavers. And it's a long time coming. I mean, you guys know this, Cleveland's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is one aspect of music, but, the Woody Guthries and the Cisco Houstons and the Josh Whites, that whole family tree is now finally being saluted. And so I'm glad to, honored to be a part of that. Mary passed away, as most of you know, in 2009. So Peter and I do the occasional. We probably do a dozen concerts a year. And as Gary pointed out, there are folks who want to hear that old material, but recognize to a large extent, and maybe it's unique to the trio, the timeliness. The re-timeliness of much of what we sing. I mean, Blowing in the Wind is still asking some pretty pertinent questions. Hammer is still enlisting a sense of participation on the part of the audience that is proper times and focused for the era in which we live.
All right, good for you. Guys, it's been such a pleasure to have you all on the show. We have been speaking with, in no particular order, Tommy James, Jeremy Clyde, Richie Furay, Gary Puckett, and Noel Paul Stuckey. I want to thank you guys for being on the show. Just awesome.
Thank you, Robert.
And we'll see you in the next episode. Take care now.
Thanks for listening to the Follow Your Dream podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss another inspiring episode. You can connect with Robert at robert@followyourdreampodcast.com. And you can hear more from his band at projectgrandslam.com.